From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, why was one of America's top anti-tax activists in town this week? Also, American Sabor, a touring exhibit of Latin music from folk to funk, and new indie rock and pop releases on this week's Sound Advice. But first, how ready is California for the next big earthquake? We know that quake is coming sometime, but will our buildings and bridges be able to handle it? And what about predicting that earthquake? How close are we to seeing when, where, and how big it'll be? We'll start our discussion with a professor of architecture at UC Berkeley who's well known internationally on these matters, Mary Comerio. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, good morning.
Well, generally speaking, how well designed are California's buildings to absorb the shock or otherwise deal with a big earthquake?
Well, California is probably one of the better prepared places on Earth, and that is the good news. We have strong building codes. We've improved our codes over the years. We've learned from recent events. But we still have older buildings. You know, we have buildings that were built before we made those improvements to the building code. So you have to look at the overall stock of the old and the new. The newly designed things perform really well. The older buildings are going to have some issues.
And give us examples of the problems that you might find in older buildings when it comes to earthquakes.
Well, there are basically three really vulnerable building types. The first is what we call unreinforced masonry, which basic terms is brick buildings. And we have a lot of those that were built, you know, after the 1906 earthquake, and we built them for fire reasons, right? We thought that they would be safer from fire to build out of masonry. And so it's not just cities like San Francisco or Los Angeles, but lots of the small communities have their downtowns built out of brick. And not all of them have been upgraded and retrofitted. Then we have older concrete buildings, which is another building type that can be vulnerable if it was built before the code changes in 1976. And then there's what we call soft story buildings. That's typically housing that's two or three stories, apartment buildings that are built over sort of open garages. And those were built in the 1960s. And we've seen those bottom floors collapse in strong earthquake motions.
My guest is Mary Comerio, professor of architecture at UC Berkeley. Have we learned from all of those lessons, those problems with buildings, older buildings in California, or are they still being built today?
Well, they're not being built today, but we haven't fixed the ones that we have. And that's really, I think, the area of concern, that we've got a lot of vulnerable buildings out there in our existing building stock that it's expensive to upgrade or it's difficult and technically. And so, you know, it's hard to convince city councils or owners that these are important issues. There are always other priorities.
What about the newer buildings? I'm guessing that that learning from earthquakes is a work in progress. Are there newer buildings that where their designs have already been superseded by more recent research?
I think that most of the newer buildings are doing fine. You know, within any class of buildings, within any group, you know, you're going to have some that are much better designed and some that are kind of poorly designed, depending on the quality of the engineering, the attention paid to it by the owner. But by and large, if they're meeting the building codes, they're going to perform pretty well.
Have we learned any lessons from the recent big earthquakes in Japan and New Zealand?
Well, I think that the Japan has showed us that, you know, the buildings that were designed well there performed pretty well. I mean, the damage was primarily from the tsunami. That and the nuclear accident were much bigger issues than the earthquake itself. In Christchurch, New Zealand, like Japan, has, you know, building codes that are very similar to the United States. What we saw were a modest earthquake, a 6.3, that was very shallow and very close to the downtown, and it exacted extremely high damage on those downtown buildings. They had ground shaking that was much higher than their building codes, and as a result, they have a lot of damaged buildings. And that, I think, we're going to be spending a lot of time studying how those buildings performed and, you know, what made them fail and what can we learn from those to improve what we do.
Do you have reason to think that perhaps there are buildings in California that we think will be able to handle an earthquake but perhaps won't?
I think there's this question of will they or won't they. It's not black and white. I think that buildings structurally will perform well and that they won't collapse, but they may have a lot of non-structural damage, damage to ceilings and partition walls and furniture toppling over, and all those things can cause injuries to people, obviously, and they also are enormously expensive to repair. And I think the big issue is that owners don't understand how much damage they can have even if the building survives structurally.
You teach at UC Berkeley. How much time do architects studying in California spend on earthquake issues?
Not enough. I think that it has never been a very high priority in architectural education, unlike in engineering where it's a more prominent thing. And I think that's a fault in our educational system. I've pushed very hard to try to correct that and to, you know, have more courses on design in earthquake country and, you know, lessons for architects. We do a lot of continuing education courses for practitioners, but I think we need to get that really in their baseline education.
And why isn't it part of the baseline education? Is it perceived as being an engineering issue and not something for the architects to worry about?
It is. I think, you know, architects in general tend to sort of say, well, the engineers will take care of that. You know, they're going to solve that problem for me. And I don't think they really see the relationship between that structural design and how well a building performs overall. In the same way that, you know, in every building you have that's designed, you don't just have architects, you have structural engineers, mechanical engineers, all kinds of technical specialties. It's been easy for the architectural profession to sort of cede that expertise to others, and I think they need to sort of recapture some of it.
Well, and they say that form follows function, and if function includes standing up in an earthquake, then that means it's part of the design.
I agree with you.
And finally, Mary, you work in an earthquake zone, the East Bay, and you perhaps even live in that area too. How does that affect you as a person who lives in that area when it comes to your home and your workspace?
Well, I am extremely risk-averse. And I was part of the program at UC Berkeley, which was called the Disaster Resistant University. And, you know, the university has invested about $1 billion in retrofitting and improving buildings. UC Berkeley is a model internationally for approaches to preparing for earthquakes. So I think we've done a huge amount to get our own house in order in terms of making our buildings and our campus more earthquake safe. And frankly, I can say the same thing about my house. I live on very solid bedrock. I've invested in new foundations and structural improvements. So I feel pretty comfortable about where I am.
Well, that's great news. Mary Camerio, Professor of Architecture at UC Berkeley, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
We'll continue our discussion about California's readiness for earthquakes by talking about our ability to predict earthquakes. My guests now are also from the Bay Area. They're David Shelley and David Hill, both research seismologists. David Hill is an emeritus seismologist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, and they were recently co-authors of a study on the impact of earthquakes on distant fault zones. David Shelley, David Hill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Indeed.
Well, I won't call either of you just David. I'll use both your first and last names. David Shelley, how close are we, if we are even close at all, to being able to predict when an earthquake is going to happen?
Well, we still can't predict with any measure of certainty when and where earthquakes are going to happen. What is currently the state of the art is earthquake forecasting, where in a probabilistic sense, go through and based on past history of earthquakes, estimate how likely various faults are to have earthquakes in the future. But this is a long-term prediction, usually a 30-year time window, and not the kind of prediction time window that most people are looking for.
You're talking about, for example, a 30 to 50% likelihood within the next 30 years, that kind of forecast.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right.
David Hill, has our ability to make at least the forecasts, even if not yet predictions, how much has that improved over the years that you've been a seismologist?
I think it's really improved enormously. People have done a lot of work, particularly in the field called paleoseismology, looking back as far as we can for the return times of these large earthquakes like the San Andreas, earthquakes on the San Andreas Fault, both in Northern and Southern California, and also elsewhere in California, to try to get a longer time window on how frequently these things happen. They don't happen like clockwork, but they do, these large earthquakes in magnitude near 8 earthquakes on the San Andreas Fault, for example, happen every few hundred years at some point on the fault. But we can't say for sure whether it's exactly 200 or 300 or 400. There's an uncertainty involved there, and getting a much better window on what that uncertainty is by going back in time is one of the big advantages that we've gained over the recent few decades.
David Hill, what's your gut feeling? Do you think we'll ever get to a point where scientists could say there will be a big earthquake tomorrow in San Francisco?
That's kind of the long-term hope in seismology that we can. A lot of us think that there must be something in the earth that gives a heads up that something may be happening on a large scale. We haven't yet found it, however.
Yeah.
We've looked very carefully, and as our instrumentation has improved, we're able to look at finer and finer details. But we still haven't found anything that's reliable, that could be reliably used in a socially useful way, you know, to do that sort of thing.
But David Shelley, given the enormous forces that are involved in an earthquake, it's just not reasonable to think that they happen out of the blue, that there must be some sort of buildup over time that somehow we'll be able to figure out.
Right. Well, it's true that we know that the tectonic plates are moving relative to each other, and that relative motion will eventually be released in an earthquake. The question is, exactly when does that release happen? As you say, the buildup happens over time, but the release happens very suddenly. So you can make analogies to like predicting exactly when or where a lightning bolt will strike. It can be a very difficult problem. And actually, some people think that it's theoretically impossible to predict earthquakes, that we will never be able to. But it may be that some earthquakes are predictable and some aren't. There may be kind of a middle ground to that debate.
David Hill, what do you think we need to acquire to be able to get closer to predicting, or at least a tighter forecast of an earthquake? Is it better equipment? Is it better understanding, or some combination?
All of those. Better equipment. I think if you ask a seismologist how to improve our understanding of the Earth, they almost all say we need more instrumentation. And that's true in the work that Dave Shelley has done to pull out the very teeny signals from these deep tremors beneath the San Andreas Fault is an example of that. As our instrumentation has improved, we have a much better ability to really see fine details of things that we didn't have any idea were happening before the instrumentation had reached this point.
Well, David Shelley, tell us a bit more about this work that you've been doing, studying these tiny, deep earthquakes, and what you've learned from that.
Yeah, so we're studying what's sometimes called tremor. It's a very weak ground vibration. It's coming from about 15 miles beneath the surface, and it was just discovered about a decade ago in the southwest Japan subduction zone. So what we think it tells us is when and where the deep part of the fault is slipping slowly. And that's a useful thing to know. It's another way to monitor what the fault is doing. And the way that the deep part of the fault deforms has implications for the way that the shallower part that generates earthquakes, how it how it deforms.
Yes. David Hill, when people feel a large, a moderately large earthquake, how likely is it that a much larger earthquake is imminent? I mean, is that ever considered to be a sign of something bigger to come?
It can be. There are lots of types of earthquake sequences. The most familiar type is the main shock aftershock sequence, where things are relatively quiet. The main shock, the big earthquake, happens. It's followed by a whole series of aftershocks that decrease in frequency and magnitude with time. And at the other extreme, typical of volcanic areas, there are earthquake swarms that begin gradually and build up and have a number of larger earthquakes of about the same size and then gradually decay. And then there's a bunch of stuff in between, and one of them is a foreshock sequence. And I think something like 20% of the earthquake main shock earthquake sequences have foreshocks. So if we could reliably identify an earthquake as a foreshock when it happens, that would be a huge step toward some form of more reliable short-term earthquake forecasting or prediction.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. That's David Hill, also David Shelley, both research seismologists at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, why was one of America's top anti-tax activists in town this week? This is Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On Talk of the Nation today, Israel, the Arab Spring, and the Middle East peace process, also the art of audio. Talk of the Nation starts at 11 right after Insight. One of America's top anti-tax activists was in town this week. He's Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform, best known for the No New Taxes pledge he urges lawmakers to sign. Most Republicans in the California legislature have signed the pledge, but a few have reportedly talked with Governor Brown about the possibility of putting a tax measure on the ballot. The governor says California needs more tax revenue, along with spending cuts to help balance the state's chronic budget deficit. He needs two GOP votes in each house, but so far doesn't have them. So, is Norquist worried that some Republicans might be wobbling on taxes? I spoke with him yesterday afternoon and asked why he came to Sacramento.
I'm in Sacramento to meet with Republican legislators, as well as the National Federation of Independent Businesses and taxpayer leaders like John Kupal with the Proposition 13 forces, the Howard Jarvis Group, as well as John Fleischman, who runs the Flash Report. All leaders in the fight to keep taxes low, and we're trying to stop Governor Jerry Brown from raising taxes again.
Are you concerned that some Republicans might now side with Governor Brown and support higher taxes, extended taxes to help balance the state budget?
Well, all the Democrats in the Assembly and the Senate have said that they will vote to raise taxes. All the Republicans so far have said that they'll oppose tax increases. They want the governor to restrain spending rather than raise taxes. But the governor has been saying for 4 or 5 months now that he was moments away from getting some Republicans to break their word to California taxpayers and to actually vote with him for higher taxes. So one is always concerned that with all the powers and financial capacity of the governorship, that he could, in fact, get somebody to break their commitment.
When you said that you expressed some concern about some Republicans breaking their word to California taxpayers, you're referring to the No New Tax pledge that you have urged Republicans and lawmakers, I guess, in general across the country to sign. How would putting a measure on the ballot violate the No New Tax pledge?
Well, the taxpayer protection pledge that almost every Republican in the Assembly and the Senate in California has signed, I think all but two of them have, is a pledge first to the citizens of California. And the pledge says that they will oppose and vote against all efforts to increase taxes on the people of California. Putting a tax increase on the ballot is not opposing a tax increase. It is facilitating a tax increase. So, yes, voting for it, either directly or voting to put a tax increase on the ballot, both are supporting efforts to raise taxes and would violate the pledge they made publicly and in writing to their constituents.
But the measure could only pass if the voters of California approved it. So how would that be a tax increase imposed on the people of California? Because they're the ones who would have signed off on it.
Well, anybody who voted against it doesn't get exempted from it. That would not protect anybody who had cheerfully voted against it. But the other fact here is the people of California have voted on this issue before and voted it down. The people of California had an election in 2010 and elected state legislators who were committed in opposition to higher taxes. So we've had a series of elections. The tax increase forces have lost those. When it was on the ballot, people said no. The last seven elections where the pro-tax increase, pro-spending forces put measures on the ballot, the people of California voted those down. Governor Brown is acting like a teenage boy on a prom date. He keeps asking the same question. He keeps getting told no, and he won't take no for the answer.
My guest is Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. He's best known for the No New Tax Pledge that his group urges lawmakers to sign, and he came to Sacramento this week. Some Republican lawmakers who have signed your No New Tax Pledge talked with the governor earlier this year, and it's fair to assume that possible tax increases or extended tax increases were on the table. Did you talk with any of those Republican lawmakers?
We've certainly communicated by letter and by email with all legislators, Republicans and Democrats, urging them to rein in spending rather than raise taxes yet again. I did not on this trip specifically speak to any of the Republicans who were being wooed.
Did you at the time, though?
I met with quite a few the other day. I didn't get a chance to sit down with, I think, the four or five who people say might be the ones who would change their mind.
Now, not all Republican lawmakers in California have signed the No New Tax Pledge. Two of the Republicans who we've been told were talking with Governor Brown earlier this year have not signed the No New Tax Pledge. Have you been trying to persuade them now to sign the pledge? And if so, what do they say to you?
Well, we've certainly done so by letters and emails. I haven't physically spoken to the two you're mentioning who have not taken the pledge. We'd certainly like them to make that commitment, but that's we urge all candidates of all parties to make that commitment if that's their position. There are some politicians who are committed to higher taxes. They don't sign the pledge.
The governor needs two Republican votes in each of the two houses of the California legislature to put tax measures on the ballot. What if he gets those two votes? Because if he does, at least two of them would be Republicans who have signed the No New Tax Pledge. What would you do as a result? Is there some specific mechanism by which you can penalize people?
Well, the people who would speak harshly to someone who broke their commitment not to raise taxes would be the people of California. The last six, perhaps seven people, Republicans, who joined in tax increases in the past have all been retired by the people of California from positions of authority. So the voters and the taxpayers of California have been very clear that people who break their word tend not to get reelected.
A couple of days ago, Governor Brown talked about, quote, visiting ideologues from the Potomac River. Probably safe to assume he was referring to you. And the Potomac River reference, I'm guessing, is basically a way of saying that this is someone who's from out of town trying to influence California governance. How would you respond to that?
Well, he sounds like the Southern sheriffs in the 1950s movies complaining about Yankees and outsiders and agitators. It's not a very grown-up position. You know, I mean, there are 50 states. We urge people in all 50 states to take the pledge if they wish to when they run. And then we share with voters whether they keep their commitment. But the people whose jobs have been destroyed in the state by Governor Brown's spending and tax policies are Californians. He's not destroying jobs in other people's states. He's damaging the economy in this state by not reining in spending.
Earlier this year, the deficit that Governor Brown faced was well over $20 billion. And with a variety of spending cuts and some other measures, he's cut that by more than half. So Governor Brown says that a balanced response is needed to a deficit of that size, a mixture of spending cuts and higher revenues. And he says he's done the spending cut side of the ledger. More money needs to come in. If no new taxes are on the table from your point of view, how would you balance the budget? Give us some specific idea.
Well, one of the things that has happened in the last few months is that revenue have come in faster than had been expected. And therefore, we do actually have more revenues than had been anticipated. What really shows Governor Brown's true colors is that he still wants to raise taxes anyway by $12 billion, even though six or more billion have come in than were expected. So this is just a guy who wants to raise taxes regardless of what the budgets are. But the problem is too much spending. The problem is not that the peasants are undertaxed. It's that the nobles and the guys in Versailles are spending too much money. And step one is the governor should apologize for the corrupt bargain that he engaged in that ridiculous contract that he approved with the correctional officers who had conveniently given him several million dollars for his recent campaign. Those kind of contracts, that kind of giveaway on pensions and contracts is what is bankrupting California. And the governor has just spit in the face of every taxpayer in the state and says he ain't doing any reform.
But you could rescind those contracts and it still wouldn't balance the budget. I mean, there would still be other tough decisions to be made. I've heard it said that you could shut down the whole higher education system in California, and it wouldn't be enough still to balance the budget.
Right. The question is, the governor wants to dramatically continue to increase spending. The reductions they're talking about in California are reductions and increases. One of the things that the governor might want to do, instead of whining about Yankee agitators as if he was some southern sheriff, is look around at the other 49 states, with the exception of Illinois, which is probably least less competently governed than California, and he'll find the governor of New York, Cuomo, saying we're not raising taxes, we have a spending problem. Ask Cuomo what he's doing. The governor of Texas, which did not have a fat, ridiculous budget the way California does, they just dropped about $15 billion out of their already fairly tight budget because they didn't want to spend more money. And they had a $9 billion rainy day fund, which they didn't touch going forward because they wanted to save a real emergency, not spend it. Florida just dropped spending. They're looking to cut spending, not raise taxes. In Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, big, serious, grown-up states, reining in spending, not raising taxes. This governor in California, Jerry Brown, along with the governor in Illinois, seem to be the only governors in the country whining and saying they're not capable of governing and making decisions. He could call around to his other governors and find out how everybody other than him is able to govern competently.
Did you meet with any Democrats while you were in Sacramento?
Very possibly, but not with Democratic legislators.
I see. Would you like to meet with Democrats?
Democrat who wants to help reform the size and scope of government? Absolutely. We ask all Democrats to take the pledge. And Ben Nelson, senator from Nebraska, signed the pledge at the national level. And a number in other states, Democrat legislators have signed the pledge, just not in California.
Grover Norquist, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, American Sabor, a touring exhibit of Latin music from folk to funk. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow you'll hear about a health insurance plan for people with those infamous pre-existing conditions and who can't buy regular insurance. Also, food writer Hank Shaw and his new book, Hunt, Gather, Cook. That's Insight tomorrow. Latin music is as varied as any music can be. It extends from folk to hip-hop and from salsa to rock. A touring exhibit from the Smithsonian Institution demonstrates this broad musical landscape. The show is called American Sabor, and it starts its national tour this week in Sacramento. We'll meet some people who are involved in the exhibit in a moment, but first here's one of the songs featured in American Sabor. It's Nana by Coke.
Na, 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 na. Na, 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 na.
on, everybody, and do your thing. It's quite easy if you give it a try. Yeah, everybody, let's all get high.
The project director from the Smithsonian behind American Sabor is in town. She's Evelyn Figueroa. Evelyn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Tell us about Coke. Where were they from?
They are from Miami, and they are one of the bands, the contemporary bands. They created a blending of music that is based on traditional Latin American rhythms with rock and R&B.
And are they? Can you actually hear music like this in the American Sabor exhibit?
Yes, American Sabor is full of music. We have from the very early pieces of music that were basically created by the pioneers of the music to the contemporary music. And that's the beauty of it. It's an evolutionary process.
Yes. What's the story behind this exhibit? I mean, it's such a huge landscape that you're choosing from, Latin music in America from the 40s onwards. How did you come up with this idea?
We work on this project with the Experience Music Project in Seattle, in Washington. They are the originators of a large-scale exhibition that was organized and traveled throughout the United States. We did a small version sponsored by Ford Motor Company Fund as a way to go to the smaller communities because they cannot have the large exhibit. And basically, we use the same concept, the same story, but told in a smaller version. And it covers the key people, the key musicians and performers that contributed to the formation of the traditional American popular music.
Yeah, well, here's a good example of that. Another artist that you can hear at the American Sabor exhibit, it's Linda Ronstadt and the song, and I hope I'm not mispronouncing it, Los Laureles. Evelyn, why is the national tour of this show starting in Sacramento?
We have a long-term relationship with Sacramento and the public library. They are friends of ours for a long time. We wanted the show to start not in Washington, D.C., but on the road, on one of the cities. Sacramento is the perfect spot. It's a very diverse community. It has a blending of culture and rhythm and music and color. And we thought that, you know, the public library was the perfect place.
Well, joining us also is Rivka Sass, who's director of the Sacramento Public Library. Rivka, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
When did you first get a chance to really check out the American Sabor exhibit, and what did you make of it?
Well, a few months ago when the idea was brought to us as we have to bring this to Sacramento and we have to do our best to be the first place, the kickoff spot for this tour, I read about it. We talked about it, and I said, let's do it. Let's get it here, and let's turn Central Library into this center for music and exploration.
And it just opened this week, right?
Today is the official first day.
Yeah, and it runs through August 7th.
Correct.
Yes. And the main sponsor of this is the Ford Motor Company. Lynn Quigley is manager of community relations. She's with us too. Lynn, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
What's Ford Motor Company's interest in Latin music?
Our main priority, our giving priority at Ford is education, and we find arts and culture to be a powerful educational tool. So American Sabor is a perfect type of program for us because it brings education into the communities and helps bring communities together through cross-cultural exchange.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's listen to another piece of music. There's so much to choose from. I was listening to the American Sabor radio on the website, on the American Sabor website, so there's lots of great music. Let's listen to Katy Perry by La Lupe and Tito Puente.
Que supieras que no hay en la vida otro amor como mi amor. Que no te di que pudiera.
That is so beautiful, and better when said correctly, Katy Perry. Tell us about that, Evelyn.
Que te pedí is a bolero. It's known as a bolero. And La Lupe was known as one of the vocalists that would perform very romantic, very, very highly romantic ballads. If you listen to the music carefully, you hear the conga behind and the bongos. That rhythm is one of those rhythms that has transcended into the American traditional popular music. It's the instrumentation in which it is. It's a bolero, it's romantic, but still have that you know, hot rhythm behind it. And she was well known because of that. She used to sing a lot with Tito Puente.
Yes.
She was many times performing with him.
Well, now music is best, I guess, when danced to. And Rivka Sass, you can actually dance to this music at the library, right?
Absolutely. We've got a nice dance space set up near the jukebox. I have this fantasy of putting dance steps on the floor. We have a salsa contest coming up on, I think, June 16th during the lunch hour, so people can come and dance in the library. Maybe we'll even do a flash mob. Who knows?
Rivka, have you taken your dancing shoes out and hit the floor yet?
Well, not yet, but I plan to.
What about you, Lynn Quigley from Ford Motor Company? Have you tested the dance floor?
No, I haven't tested the dance floor, but I love to dance the cha-cha, so I'm hoping to give that a try soon.
Yeah. Evelyn, I bet you've tried it out.
I was born dancing. So dance is a very important part of the Latino music. Actually, dance is one of those elements that came into traditional American music. It came with the Latino rhythms. And like we say in the Latino cultures, you feel the music and you will dance.
Yeah. Let's listen to one more clip. This is Miami Sound Machine. Rhythm is going to get you. Well, American Sabor, it sounds like a lot of fun. It's a touring national exhibit from the Smithsonian. It starts its national tour today in Sacramento at the Central Library, presented by our sponsor, Ford Motor Company. Lynn Quigley, thanks for joining us. Rivka Sass, director of the Sacramento Public Library, thanks for joining us. And Evelyn Figueroa, it was a pleasure meeting you.
Same here. Thank you for inviting us.
So American Sabor runs through August 7th at the Central Library. You're listening to Insight. When we come back, some new indie rock and pop releases on Sound Advice. This is Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On Capital Public Radio News today, the San Joaquin Valley's air is famously polluted. Now there is more surveillance of it. Northern Valley air quality officials just opened a third monitoring station in Manteca. Should help give people a better idea of what's in the air. It's time now for our weekly music feature, Sound Advice. The fourth Thursday of the month, we check out new releases in indie rock and pop with Nick Bruner. He's host of Off Air, Capital Public Radio's online music show. Nick, welcome back.
Glad to be back, Jeffrey.
Last time we talked, there was a little holdup with Off Air. Everything running smoothly this month?
Everything is raring to go, and I can credit the producer of this show, Insight, with helping walk me through that a little bit. So, yeah, smartrockradio.org now has the latest episode of Off Air.
Well, that's just what you expect from Jen Picard, isn't it?
You do indeed.
Okay. Well, let's listen to some music. What are we going to start with?
We're going to start with a group that's probably best known for their mid-90s indie pop. They're a Japanese-born duo that have recently gotten back together for a tour and a potential album. Looks like it will be happening in 2012. Chibo Motto have a new single called Sugar Water.
Like a sense of the southern island.
that sort of half-whispered voice really pulls me in.
Yes, that's Miho Hattori. She's terrific. She's been through Sacramento once or twice on solo tours as well. The interesting thing about that song that you just heard is it's only available as a video on YouTube right now. So we had to pull the audio from the internet to play this week's show.
And it's called Sugar Water, a.k.a. soda, I guess.
I suppose so, yeah.
Well, that's our first song today. What's our second?
There's a new EP by a group of Chicago musicians that have been a long-running sort of indie rock act called The Sea and Cake. They have a new EP out called The Moonlight Butterfly, and this is their first release since their 2008 full-length called Car Alarm. This song is called Covers.
On a moment true, yeah, locked on, I'll give it all. I tell them I'm a what or why, I let it seem, I left on. Still let fractures rise, I give a choice, I spell it out. If I don't miss the shots on Avenue, I come alive.
The band called The Sea and Cake, no relation to the Sacramento band Cake, I guess.
No. In fact, it's a, from what I've been told, The Sea and Cake is a misinterpretation of The Sea in Cake, which is a song.
Really?
Yeah. That's that particular song just really grips me. I mean, there's lots of layers about it, and it spins a really great sticky web of sound that I'm happy to be stuck in.
Yeah, I like those jangling guitars. They're almost slightly discordant occasionally, but they add the sort of, I don't know, sort of pulsing kind of.
The swirling effect helps a lot, too. I like that a lot. So.
I like the swirl. It's Sound Advice. My guest is Nick Bruner. He joins us the fourth Thursday of each month. He's the host of Off Air, which you can hear each week at smartrockradio.org. What's next?
This is a formerly secret project by members. Well, it's a duo. One of them is Alistair MacLean. He's best known for his work in The Clientele right now. And Lupe Nunez Fernandez of a UK group called Pipas. Their new album is called The Street of the Love of Days, and they're collectively known as Amor de Dias.
If it's okay, I'm going to the rocky garden full of stars. Can you find the time to meet me? There I fear it's very far. You provoked me to be lonely. Words are geographical.
I think it's really beautiful. It's got a slightly psychedelic sound to it and another whispery vocal that really gets your attention.
I am notoriously hard to stay still when it comes to a quiet sort of introspective record, but there's something about this one that really just keeps me in my place. That track, Bunhill Fields, is about as aggressive as the entire album gets, but don't mistake that for something being, the rest of the album being boring. It's really engaging and very intimate and very commands your attention even on the quietest of tracks.
Yeah, very imaginative arrangement. It just keeps adding instruments and you don't know where it's going. Like it very much. So that's track number three. We get time for a couple more. What's number four?
Taking a turn from the whispery vocals into something a bit more dancey, and this is something of a turn for this next band. They're called Gang Gang Dance. They're out of New York. Their new album is called Eye Contact, and this is a really kind of druggy dance track called Mind Killer.
I'm
That's great. It's got a slightly manic quality to it, and the synths have a little bit of an 80s sound to them.
Mm-hmm. And it's, I've described it as a little less, their last album was a lot more psychedelic, and the tracks bled together a lot more. This album, Eye Contact, is a lot less hippie in the woods and more hippie in the city. A lot of Mid-Eastern and musical influences, yeah. Indian is there as well. It's a really engaging listen. I recommend it strongly.
Mind Killer,
mm-hmm.
as in ending with an A as, instead of ER.
Like the kids talk now, Jeffrey.
Like the kids
M-I-N-D-K-I-L-L-A. You got no time for ER.
That's right.
Not in the internet generation, sir.
Yes. Well, we've got one more track on Sound Advice. What is it?
This is a shorty. It's from a Bay Area trio called Nodes. Their new album is called Innings on a nice little label called Woodsist. And this track is named Heyday Past, Heyday Do.
And even a little bit of na 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 sound to the vocals.
A little bit, yeah. I don't know if they intended to do this, but every time I hear that song, I like to think they're discussing the overall human condition as framed by one particular party that they all went to.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it just sounds just really philosophical, even if I can't make out of everything that they're saying in that track.
And when they say heyday past, heyday do, is that like you've had your heyday, it's gone? Is it that the kind of heyday they're talking about?
That sounds good to me, sure.
Okay, we'll go with that one. Nick Bruner is host of Off Air, Capital Public Radio's indie music show. You can hear it every week at smartrockradio.org. It's uploaded each Wednesday night, early Thursday morning. And he joins us the fourth Thursday of each month for our Sound Advice segment. Nick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
And that's Insight for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Today's associate producer is Christine Guerra. Susan Morar and Liz Cazares. The technical director of Insight is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Californians have a hard time getting insurance due to pre-existing conditions, but a new plan created under the federal healthcare overhaul may help. On the next Insight, we'll talk about this. Plus, the 38th Sacramento Jazz Festival kicks off this weekend. Also, local food blogger Hank Shaw's new book about hunting, gathering, and cooking. And the B Street Theatre takes on The Diary of Anne Frank. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.